This is WJBC This Week.
No, he's a carnival barker, entertainer, clown.
We have to give ourselves oxygen. We have to make sure that we deliver quality services and protect the citizens of Bloomington.
We have great people, but we're human. You know, oftentimes there is mistakes and errors made.
And I know I got a lot to learn, but I look forward to hitting the ground running, being the best member of Congress I can, and working hard for my district.
The cold, hard fact of life is you cannot help everyone.
We've placed extra hand sanitizers around campus, and we're thoroughly cleaning high-traffic areas.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, Bloomington's mayor discusses what the city would do with the sales tax increase that the council will consider on Monday. We'll meet Illinois Wesleyan's new president, whose selection was announced this week. We'll get analysis on two reports that show escalating pension costs in the state. Our Susan Saunders chats with Old West legend Wild Bill Hickok, as done by All My Children star Walt Willie, ahead of his show at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Plus, WJBC's Throwback Thursday interview with the former assistant news director, Lori Nelson. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Months of studying and planning in the city of Bloomington will come to a head Monday night when the city reviews the final recommendations from a task force that's been looking for ways to plug a multi-million dollar deficit. The city council will also vote on a key part of that plan, a 1% increase in the sales tax. Mayor Terry Renner talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
We have a report from the budget task force a preliminary report that was given several weeks ago. It's formally presented to us on Monday. And the budget task force's recommendations are very balanced. There was recognition that we are going to have to raise some taxes and fees, and we're also going to have to cut services. And so the council is going to be considering all of those over the next several months. The one that is coming up first is the so-called sales tax increase, the penny, because of the fact that a quarter of that would be designated for mental health. It's the county's timetable that is driving this and requiring us to act on that piece first. And so we will see on Monday whether or not that's the case. As it is presented, the one penny sales tax, if it's passed, a quarter would go to mental health. So that would go to the county. We would have an intergovernmental agreement to make that happen. A quarter would go to infrastructure, street resurfacing, and probably sidewalks is what it would probably ultimately be done for. And we could even do a bond to leverage that for a bond to really have a maximum impact on the community up front. And then the other half penny would go to essentially police, fire, public works, or general fund, because we have a deficit. Now, that still won't get us there. We have to do cuts. We have to do other things as we prepare for our next fiscal year, which begins April 30th. So we're way ahead of the game, frankly. But the budget task force and the city council will be considering a very balanced approach.
Mayor, I know that the town of Normal sent a letter asking that Bloomington consider spending this sales tax money on some joint projects, basically the same way Normal intends to spend the money.
Right, and that is a letter that's not actually in their ordinance. The ordinance that they passed has one penny and a quarter for mental health. The letter that Mayor Kuss sent me and the council specifies some of their priorities. None of that will be in our ordinance. Our ordinance is not going to specify that, and then those are Normal's priorities. Some of those after the fact, if we can afford it, we might consider. But right now, let me just take soccer. I mean, obviously, we've got to do something about soccer. But we have to keep our doors open. We've got to fund public safety. We've got to fund public works. We've got to make sure that that's taken care of before we can consider to spending anything on soccer. Soccer's not, there's no support. I don't think there's a single vote on my council for that. And no matter how much we need it, those are priorities that were expressed by Normal. We have a structural deficit. We've got to close it. And so that's our highest priority. We might consider Connect Transit. That would be a much smaller amount of money if we can stabilize our budgetary situation. But we'd consider that after the fact. It's a little like when you're on an airplane, and it says, if the bags fall because there's a lack of oxygen, give yourself oxygen first and then help others. And at this point, we have to give ourselves oxygen. We have to make sure that we deliver quality services and protect the citizens of Bloomington.
So can I take this to also mean that the school superintendent's request is out the window?
Well, I have yet to talk to everybody on the council. There's a little bit of support, but mostly there's not. There doesn't seem to be a majority support for the schools to add yet another quarter penny onto that. Now, let's just also be clear. If we look at the tax rates for metro cities and downstate, at this point, we are the lowest in terms of the sales tax. So we would not want to raise a tax where we would put ourselves at a competitive disadvantage. And that, I think, both the councils of Bloomington and Normal agree on. So we would want to be, certainly wouldn't want to be toward the high end. Even with this, we would still be on the low end. And they'd all be around somewhere, just a little below 9 or 9, 9, 9 and a quarter. If this passes, we'd be at 8.75, and that's total. That's the state's share, the city share, et cetera.
What about the impact of the referendum? I mean, there was a failed sales tax referendum. Do you see that as the voters have spoken?
I think there was... There is definitely some concern on the council that if we were to add even a quarter penny for the schools, it might look like we were doing an end run around the schools, an end run around the voters. I think the voters were reacting to a penny, and they were reacting to a penny that was designated for capital expenditures. And I think some thought, well, you know, that what about operations? If I'm going to pay a penny, I don't know that I want to go for that. But let me just sort of back up. With all of the issues that we have, the thing that struck me and drove the point home, if I didn't know it already, is what a failure we've seen in leadership from Springfield, because we have our schools that are now left to fend for themselves, and yet with mandates from Springfield, who can't afford to provide the quality education that they've been providing in the past. We have mass transit that the state has abandoned. We've got mental health. We've got to deal with these problems here locally. And, you know, at the end of the day, this is unfortunate. It's really unfortunate. We can't count on Springfield for anything, frankly, other than to meddle in our business. And that's a real serious problem.
I called it a long time ago when the state was talking about cutting here, cutting there, that these are things that have to be paid for. And who's going to pay for them? It's going to come down to the local level. And now we're kind of seeing that happen.
We are seeing it. And just on that point, if I could, at the state or the federal level, you don't always know what you're getting for your taxes. And they can mandate other local, you know, other levels of government to do things. At the local level, we don't give anybody any other grants. You pay us, and we provide you services, police, fire, public works. That's most of it, some parks and rec. We don't have any slush funds. We don't have any money that goes anywhere. It goes right into delivering public services. So it's frankly, in many ways, the most honest level of government.
Why are we talking about a 1% tax increase, sales tax increase, when we haven't had the report back from your committee?
Well, we actually had the budget task force's final draft several weeks ago, which basically calls for a 1%, or not 1%, a 1 penny sales tax increase. And so,
but that's only suggested.
Yeah, well, that's the recommendation, right? So this is consistent with the recommendation, Scott.
So,
and then in addition, it's also consistent with, and this is a separate process that the town of Normal did, but the thing that's driving this, because our fiscal year ends April 30th, the thing that's driving this more quickly is the county's timetable, because the county's fiscal year goes through the calendar year.
Yeah.
So it goes from January 1st to December 31st. So if we don't act with the county, then the county will be out for mental health for a year or a year and a half, potentially.
That was Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner with Scott and Colleen. Illinois Wesleyan University named its 19th president in school history this week. Eric Jensen, a Homewood, Illinois native, comes to Bloomington from Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he was provost. Jensen discussed his goals for the university when he talked with WJBC this week.
What are your thoughts as you prepare to take over the reins of this university?
Well, I'm excited. Illinois Wesleyan's a wonderful place, long tradition, sound foundation, has enjoyed wonderful leadership over the years, and I'm looking forward to being a part of that.
First, a little bit about your background, coming most recently from Hamline University in St. Paul, where you were provost for 3 years.
Right.
Just a little bit about your career in education as you prepare to come here.
Well, I'm an economist by training. I worked in developing countries on issues regarding the economic performance of reproductive health programs and why people have as many children as they do and so forth. I became an administrator when I was asked to be one at William & Mary because they kind of needed help getting some things done. And as I did it, I realized there was a great deal of satisfaction, a lot of opportunity in that kind of a job, and that ended me up at Hamline and then here.
What do you feel in particular about your background makes you uniquely qualified to step into this role?
Well, I have a sound academic background, and after all, we're an academic institution. I'm comfortable with fundraising, and I really enjoy helping to create, design, and implement new programs. And so I think that there's a number of sort of interesting possibilities that await, I think, further conversation on campus as to sort of what directions we might go. But clearly, both a sound foundation upon which to build and a willingness to think about what the future might look like.
Okay, let's go down the path of new programs. What do you have in mind?
Well, as I say, I think it's premature to talk about those things now. I think really what I'd like to do is facilitate a discussion with a larger community about what I referred to as something that's uniquely Illinois Wesleyan in my remarks downstairs.
Mm-hmm. What do you see is unique about Illinois Wesleyan and the tradition of the history here in Bloomington?
Illinois Wesleyan's got this 165-year tradition of really caring about their students, of having top-notch faculty, of attracting good students, and of making them into maybe more than they knew they could be before they came.
First day in office, what are your plans in, say, first 90 to 100 days?
Well, I think that's the getting acquainted period. I think the first day in office, who knows? But the first 90 to 100 is, that's a lot of walking around. That's a lot of meeting people. That's a lot of convening meetings to talk about, again, the sorts of issues we were just discussing.
Sure. And, of course, universities across the country are dealing with some difficult financial times for multiple factors, public and private both. How do you approach that?
Well, with a sort of sense of clear-eyed realism that we don't make the world in which we operate, but the world in which we operate creates some opportunities for us. And so I think that what's going to emerge over time is a notion of just how special institutions like Illinois Wesleyan are. And it's our job to reinforce that specialness and to reinforce people's knowledge of that specialness as we move forward.
President Wilson, leaving after 11-plus years here at the university, what have your conversations with him been like, and what kind of advice are you looking for from him, and what kind of things are you talking about as you make the transition?
Well, we've really only met over the past few days. He's been wonderfully welcoming and is going out of his way to ease the transition. As to what the specifics might be, well, we'll see as we move forward.
Sure. And just a little bit about what inspires you, what motivates you, what excites you about education and about this position?
Well, fundamentally, a university is a mission-driven place. We are in the job of transforming lives. And the notion that after you've done that, you can look at it and say, I helped, that's deeply rewarding.
And I'm sure you're familiar with the Transforming Lives campaign, which has been ongoing here for a number of
years.
Is
there a campaign?
Yeah. How coincidental, yeah. Right?
yeah. A coincidental choice of words, I'm sure.
That was Illinois Wesleyan's incoming president, Eric Jensen. A report from the Chicago Sun-Times and the Better Government Association shows Illinois, Cook County, and Chicago paid more than $2 million in pension benefits from 2010 to 2014 to people who had already died. While the number of state retirees drawing a six-figure pension has grown 18% in the past year, Chief Operating Officer for the nonpartisan website Reboot Illinois, Madeline Dubeck, talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week about the pension checks going to the deceased.
We're not talking $20, $30 a month here, Ari. We're talking about big bucks checks.
That's right. So this is actually an investigation, a joint investigation that was done initially by the Better Government Association and the Chicago Sun-Times. And they checked back 4 years from 2010 to 2014 and found that the state in, and the city of Chicago and Cook County, 11 out of 15 major pension funds have sent $2.2 million in payments to more than 1,000 dead people that they know of so far.
This is just, they think they've only scratched the surface on this?
Well, they acknowledge that quite often when someone dies, the surviving relatives don't always know what to do and who they need to report to and how to handle these things. So they are unfortunately not uncovered all the time right away.
So how has it happened that it's grown, it continues to grow, to people who are getting six-figure pensions? The number that you quoted from a year ago was a little over 12,000 to this past year, over 14,000. The problem is just not going away.
Well, it never probably will go away because this is actually a separate story that the Better Government Association reported. And it's something that we have looked at quite a bit over the past few years. It's not going to go away because people's, hopefully, in a good economy, people's salaries are never going to go down. They're always going to go up. You usually get, you know, at least even a small cost of living increase. And in the case of pensions, back in the early 1990s, the state legislature saw fit to allow for compounding interest in the annual cost of living adjustment that every state worker gets. So, you know, whenever you're thinking about your own retirement in the private sector, you always hear about the power of compounding interest.
Sure.
And that power is socking it right to us in the public sector. So compounding interest is really one of the main cost drivers that's driving up pensions and therefore driving up our pension payments and our pension debt because we're not properly funding pensions. We haven't for decades. And those same lawmakers have seen fit to skip payments and take pension holidays and borrow money to pay pension payments. And so all of those things have put us in this worst in the nation pension debt problem.
Hey, we lead the country in something, I guess.
That's number one.
Gee whiz.
In all the bad categories.
Yeah, of the pension payments that have gone out to folks who have already passed away, as you report in this piece that you did, is that a lot of these are hundreds of thousands of dollars go out erroneously, and people are making mistakes. They understand that. Is anything being done to check and double check before the check goes into the mail?
Well, there's certainly a lot being done, and I should point out that the couple of million dollars here in the grand scheme of things is really a tenth of a percent of the total billions that go out in the form of pension payments every year by all of these funds.
Mm-hmm.
And they are obligated by law and to keep their standing as a pension fund that they have to go back after the fact when they find out that somebody was getting payments they shouldn't have and seek out whoever may be taking advantage of that and seek repayment. And in most cases, they're able to do that. But, of course, it takes some time, and sometimes you can't find people. The original story did feature a couple of people who, in fact, you know, collected several tens of thousands of dollars that they knew didn't belong to them because the money goes direct deposited into people's accounts sometimes, and then surviving relatives control those accounts.
And maybe don't check them as they should, or things like that.
Or they check them and they withdraw
the
money
took them.
And take a nice vacation.
Exactly. You speak of one in here, a retired City of Chicago truck driver. His name was William A. Galvin, Jr. He died in October of 2004, but his pension checks kept coming via direct deposit to his bank account for six more years before it was discovered that he had died. And he has the largest posthumous pension payment, $203,000. And this is going on again. These stories are coming up because there's so much angst over, we got to get a budget. And certainly now we've got to get some pension reform. Does it all kind of flow into that same stream of thought?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think everybody is really kind of grasping at whatever straws they can find out there to try to get their arms around this gargantuan pension debt problem.
That was Madeline Dubeck of Reboot Illinois with Dan Sweeney. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Actor Walt Willey is an Ottawa, Illinois native, known best for his role as Jackson Montgomery on ABC's All My Children. Willey is back in Central Illinois this weekend as Old West legend Wild Bill Hickok in a performance Sunday at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Willey talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
The amazing Walt Willey is in studio. I've followed your career my entire
life.
You
sound like a magician.
No, but you
are. The amazing Randy.
You are a magician in the way you transform yourself into Wild Bill Hickok. And when you were living in Ottawa before you became so well known for your other ventures through daytime television, when did this moment happen that you decided he's my guy? Because now you are Wild Bill Hickok live on stage, the BCPA this Sunday, and you've done countless television and YouTube shows as Wild Bill Hickok. When did he come to be your new best friend?
I was looking for when the writing was clearly on the wall and had been actually for some time that All My Children was not going to be around for long. I started looking for a one-man show. I had been doing stand-up comedy for over 20 years at that point, and I was kind of done with it. Mm-hmm. I was getting a little old for the road like that. And I wanted to find a – I read probably 20 one-man shows, and I didn't want to do Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln, and everybody was doing Lincoln.
But you have the height for it. I could see you as
Lincoln. I do have the height for it, but when you grow up in Illinois, you get a little done with Lincoln at some point. And we were doing Arsenic and Old Lace, and my son was doing it. We were going to Mendota, Illinois, to the Amtrak station there to pick up my wife and daughter, who were coming in to see the show. They like to travel by train for some unknown reason because they like to spend 24-plus hours looking at nothing. And
look, cow.
Rocking back and forth on really bad tracks. But we went to pick them up, and we took the scenic route, which took us through Troy Grove, Illinois. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether I knew it and forgot, because I can't imagine that I didn't know the Wild, because we saw the sign, Troy Grove, Illinois, birthplace of James Butler Wild Bill Hickok. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether I knew it and forgot it. I can't imagine I didn't know it, because when I was a kid, you know, I'm 60-plus years old. When I was a kid, that's all that was on TV were Westerns. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine that I didn't know that the iconic Wild Bill Hickok was born in the same county I was. But I didn't. And I thought, wow, well, let me look into him. And the first thing I found out is that he was 6'2" and blonde and blue and born in the same place and left town and became famous. And I thought, well, let me really research this man. And so once I got past the legend, which is, of course, unbelievable, as all legends are, and found out the true facts of the man, it was even more fascinating. He was the first media-generated celebrity. He did an interview with a man by the name of George Ward Nichols in 1865 after the Civil War, in which Hickok was considered a hero for his work as a civilian scout. He never joined the Army because he had seen rank bestowed on too many fools to join the Army, but they were more than happy to have him work for them as a civilian scout. He was talking to this man, telling him of his adventures with some exaggeration, undoubtedly, not knowing that this man would turn this into an article that was published in Harper's Magazine in 1867. 2 years later, Hickok had, I'm sure, more than forgotten about this conversation. It came out. It was reprinted in every newspaper on the East Coast, up and down. Then the dime novelists started in writing about Wild Bill Hickok. And next thing Hickok knew, when he came back from scouting in 1867, he was the second most famous man in the United States, and the most famous man, Lincoln, was dead. So he never had to buy a drink or dinner after that. He had the excursionists, the sightseers, all screaming for him to lead them out to see the West, you know. He was famous. And the burden of fame was, it was both a boon and a bust for him. I mean, it really, it's a Greek tragedy. Here's this man who was truly one of the best marksmen of his time. The first truly famous gunfight between he and Davis Tutt. His shot Tutt through the heart at 75 yards, at 225 feet.
And yet late in his
with
life.
With a cap and ball pistol. And then, as he's working as a lawman, he begins to lose his eyesight.
Right.
He begins to go blind. I mean, that's a Greek tragedy.
It's horrifying.
Here you are, working, making your living, wearing a tin star, shining in the moonlight like a bullseye. And everybody wants to be the man who killed Wild Bill Hickok, and you're losing your eyesight. I mean, it's just, I mean, you can't make stuff like that up.
It's going to be an incredible.
That was his life.
It's going to be an incredible show. I hope you cover things on Sunday like a Calamity Jane. You know.
Oh, I straighten a lot of stuff out.
Good.
I straighten a lot of stuff out.
Confusion there. I can't wait to see you in the full persona. And folks, there are very few tickets left, so go get yours through artsblooming.org through the city of Bloomington. Walt Willie, a last question real quick.
Sure.
As you have so many fans of you in general, will you be available for autographs and pictures after?
You know, I always do a Q&A right after the show. Okay. And interestingly enough, I knew I had a hit. I guess in the 40 or 50 times I've done this show, I've gotten maybe a handful of questions about all my children. So I knew people were compelled
by
Wild Bill.
Good.
So, but I'll take questions about all my children. I don't have a problem with that at all.
I just want to know
if the selfie sticks
were welcome.
We had selfie sticks are welcome as long as you don't ask me to hold them. Yes, we'll do a meet and greet. We'll do a Q&A after the show for as long as people want to do it.
Catch up with one of Central Illinois' most famous, illustrious, and grand residents, Walt Willie at waltwillieworld.com.
That was All My Children's Walt Willie with Susan Saunders. Lori Nelson, now Lori Loughlin, had two tours of duty at WJBC and became WJBC's assistant news director and better half to one Scott Loughlin. She talked about her time at WJBC with Scott and Colleen at our Throwback Thursday interview.
It was my second job out of college. So graduated from ISU and worked in radio news over in Peoria, really for just a few months, maybe for 3 or 4 months, and learned of the job opening here and interviewed for it and was offered the job. So I was at the station from 1984 until, I want to say 1992 or 3, and I took off about a year sort of in the middle there to go work for a media relations firm up in Chicago.
Lori, what brought you back after you went to the big city and sort of switched careers? What lured you back?
Oh, the big city.
One Scott Loughlin lured me back.
I said
we were engaged to be married.
Oh, I thought you came back because we got you a job back at the radio station.
Well, there was that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you came back for love.
I did.
Yeah. And
I stayed.
Yeah, and you stayed. Thank you very much for doing that, by the way.
But when you came back, Steve Vogel kind of lured you back also because he needed an assistant news director.
Right. So Steve Vogel was the news director. He was the one who hired me, and Alan Sender was the assistant news director. And honestly, you know, part of the reason I left and went to Chicago was, well, number one, the lure of Chicago. Always wanted to know, you know, what it would be like to live there because I love Chicago. But the other thing was the radio station at that time had a lot of stability. You know, people just didn't leave. We had lots and lots of long-term employees, and I sort of looked at it and I thought, well, you know, nobody here in management is ever going to leave. There will never be an opportunity for me to move up. So that's part of the reason why I left. And so then while I was in the Chicago, Alan Sender did leave. He took a job at Chestnut. So, yeah, that assistant news director position opened up, and Steve Vogel called me and said, I'd love for you to come back and be assistant news director. So ultimately that's what I did.
And I have to say, as someone who was here during that transition, it was a nice experience for me to see a woman put into a leadership position in what was, in many cases, even back then, still kind of a man's world in journalism.
Yeah. Well, nice. Thank you. Yeah.
But there were other women. Who? Let's talk about your time here. Who were you working with? Who was in the newsroom? Because it was a lot bigger than it is today.
It was. We had a full-time news staff of 9 people, and that included, you know, Dick Ludke as sports director, and Art Sechrist was our full-time farm director, and then we had a full-time staff of 7 people. So Steve Vogel, Alan Sender, Stacy Marshall-Kern was in the newsroom when I started there, Sarah Curtis, Dwayne Moss.
You're missing a big one.
Tell me.
Howard Packowitz.
Howard Packowitz.
How can you forget
in my
Howard?
Time, I mean, there were a lot of people who, and part-timers and people who came through.
And Adam Nielsen, I think, was
Adam
also
Nielsen,
part of that staff.
L.P. Yeah. Phillips, Jim Cheney, Scott Ross, Trudy Schindeldecker.
Scott
you
Ross.
Remember these names?
Yeah, I remember Scott Ross. Who was Jim Cheney? Who was
Jim
it?
Jim Cheney.
I don't remember him. Colleen doesn't either.
Hmm. I think that wasn't during my time. That might have been during your first stint.
I think you're right.
So, Lori, for you, what were some of the more memorable stories that you covered? I think we're using one of them in our 90th anniversary clip.
You are. So some of the big ones I remember were the quote-unquote beer riots at ISU. And that happened because that was back in the day when there were huge drinking parties at ISU, huge drinking parties, and you would have frat houses and apartment complexes that were near single-family homes. And so these parties were big and loud and hundreds of people and went on all night long. So over the summer, the Normal Town Council passed this mass gathering ordinance that really sort of put all these measures in place to clamp down on that. Well, the students came back in the fall and found out about it, and there was a big protest on campus one night that ultimately made national news, and I was there covering that. So that's one that I remember. The triple murder at the S&S liquor store happened during my time at WJBC, the David Hendricks retrial, the drought that we lived through. There was a period of time, I think Bloomington went something like 2.5 or 3 years without any rainfall, and the lake levels were very low, and we were just a few weeks away from, you know, having water trucked in by the National Guard. So, yeah, those are some of the ones that I remember.
Yes, we reported weekly on the water levels at the lake.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I remember that.
I remember the drought. I don't remember
scary
reporting.
Right, and you had a lot of what they called water narcs who were calling
right. Well,
into the city.
Restrictions that, you know, people couldn't wash their cars. They couldn't fill their swimming pools. They really tried, you know, Bloomington did everything it could to try to conserve water because we were very close to being without our water source.
Restaurants were told not
right.
to offer water, only give it to them if asked. And
exactly.
People were asking
right.
for smart water, Jesse water, something like that. It's one of his ideas, I guess. At the time.
And Jesse Smart was mayor at the time, and so he was one of the regularly covered figures. Paul Harmon was mayor at the time. Any other, I guess, recollections of your time?
Well, our first child was born while I worked at the radio station.
Oh, the super media baby.
That's a big one.
That was so weird. I mean, you know, I'm doing mornings over at B&Q, and she's over here doing morning news with Munson, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So between the two of us, we had probably 80% of the listening audience. And when TJ was born, strangers were coming up to view the baby, and I was like, "What's the big? What's going on?" I didn't get it.
Yeah.
I didn't realize. We were like royalty. We were like the prince and princess or whatever over in England, and the baby. Uh-huh. They were waiting outside the hospital for Lori to come out.
Oh, they were not. No, but this did happen. So TJ was born, and I went to the nursery one morning. It was early. It was about 6 o'clock, and he had some troubles when he was born. Turned out fine. Anyway, so he's in the nursery, and I left my room and I was going, excuse me, to the nursery to see him. And there was this gaggle of volunteers standing outside the nursery, peering in the window, and wanted to know which one was the WJBC baby. So I'll never forget that. That was pretty funny.
That was former WJBC Assistant News Director Lori Nelson Lachlan with Scott and Colleen at our Throwback Thursday interview. The Weekend News is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. The Bloomington City Council heard from a number of residents on a proposed 1% sales tax increase at a public hearing this week. WJBC's Joe Ragusa says their responses were mixed.
Charles Smith spoke about the need to fund mental health programs.
I know many of the people who need these services. They're good people. They have lives, families, they want to work. Very often the mental illness gets in the way of that.
25% of the proposed sales tax increase would go towards helping McLean County fund mental health needs. Another 25% would go towards street resurfacing, and the remainder would go into the general fund. Bruce Meek says he has an issue with sales tax increase and home rule in general.
Where's the sunset clause on sales taxes? There isn't one. With home rule, if you do a sales tax increase, it's never going to go away.
The proposal will be voted on Monday. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
And some Bloomington residents at that meeting called for the city to fire City Manager David Hales as Bloomington works to plug an expected gap in the budget. Hales tells WJBC's Scott Lachlan anyone in a public position is going to be subject to criticism.
We have great people, but we're human. You know, oftentimes there is mistakes and errors made. You take responsibility for that, you learn from it, and move on.
Hale says he works under a contract, so if at any time the city council feels his performance is unsatisfactory, the council has the ability to make a change. A Republican strategist predicts Donald Trump will start to drop in the polls in the presidential race after what he considered to be a poor showing by Trump in this week's debate.
No, he's a carnival barker entertainer, clown, and that's. But the good news from Republican perspective is, I think that the moment that he patted Carly Fiorina on the head and said, "You are beautiful," which usually gets you slapped.
Former Illinois Republican Party Chairman Pat Brady tells WJBC Trump appears to have no campaign organization in Illinois and will have some work ahead of him just to get on the ballot here. The son of former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood is the newest House member, replacing a disgraced former congressman. Republican Darren LaHood was sworn in this week, and Republicans now hold 247 House seats, the most since 1931.
And I know I got a lot to learn, but I look forward to hitting the ground running, being the best member of Congress I can, and working hard for my district.
The 47-year-old LaHood served in the Illinois Senate and was a state and federal prosecutor before winning a special election to succeed Republican Aaron Schock, who resigned in March. LaHood reminded colleagues that in addition to his father, other predecessors from the 18th District include Abraham Lincoln, Everett Dirksen, and Bob Michael. The Illinois Department of Public Health has declared a mumps outbreak at Heartland Community College. The state says four cases have been found at the school. Letters are being sent to students, faculty, and staff. The department has determined were in close contact with those who were infected. Heartland spokeswoman Becky Gropp says the school is being proactive in its response to the outbreak.
We've placed extra hand sanitizers around campus, and we're thoroughly cleaning high traffic areas and any areas where infected individuals have communicated that they visited.
As of this week, 16 cases of mumps have been identified in McLean County, and more tests are pending. McLean County is seeking a 4% increase to its budget next year, in part to pay for expanded mental health care, a new telephone system, and an expansion of Tawanda Barnes Road. The county is looking to set aside an additional $1.3 million as part of a $92 million budget to a jail expansion to provide treatment for the mentally ill. The county is proposing raising the property tax rate about 1%, meaning the owner of a $165,000 home would pay about $5 per year more. County employees would get raises of 1.5%. County Administrator Bill Wasson told the county board the county also plans to eliminate 5 positions and look for places to cut elsewhere.
We have to work to find efficiencies relative to expenditures as well, and this reflects challenges and the work that has been done by our departments.
The county board will vote on the budget in November, and the Obama administration has suggested allowing 10,000 refugees in from Syria. Senator Dick Durbin believes that proposal was too modest. He's calling for up to 100,000 refugees to be accepted.
We are a caring, compassionate nation. When we are dealing with refugees from around the world, we do our part. We can't take them all. We shouldn't take them all. We should vet every single one of them. But let's remind the people what our values are in this nation, and I think they're good values.
Durbin says the U.S. has accepted refugees from other countries affected by war or persecution, such as Cuba, Somalia, and Bosnia, and that he wants what he calls a great American tradition to continue. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It's time to take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, the Bloomington City Council will vote on the proposed 1 cent sales tax increase that's already been approved by the Normal Town Council, though it's conditioned on Bloomington doing the same. Normal's Town Council will also meet on Monday. On Tuesday, Illinois Wesleyan will dedicate a new art sculpture that's been donated to the university. On Thursday, the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council will present BN by the Numbers at the ISU Alumni Center. And Saturday morning, it's the inaugural McLean County St. Jude Walk to End Childhood Cancer at Hancock Stadium. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.